This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again. And as always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or tuned into our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show. And you're doing that on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Really excited for the next hour. Today's guest is appearing on Trainer Talk for a third time today. And when he was first on the show, this particular show, it was July of 2013. He had saddled close to 2,200 winners at that point in his career. His runners had accumulated purse earnings of nearly $52 million. Today, he is fast approaching 3,200 victories, and his runners have earned more than $86 million in purses. Yeah, to say it's been a good seven-year run is maybe an understatement. He'll be looking to add to that total this Saturday as he goes in search of his first Triple Crown victory with the talented Mr. Big News in 145th running of the Preakness Stakes. Please join me in welcoming the 56-year-old native of Dallas, Texas. He is trainer Brett Calhoun, and he's here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Brett, welcome, my friend.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Happy to have you along for the ride. You know, in addition to those numbers I just threw out there, you've racked up 12 graded stakes wins over the past 21 months or so, including a big score in the ACAC at Churchill last weekend. What's been the key to keeping this thing rolling at such a high level?
Faster horses. Yeah, we've had the opportunity to get some better horses over the last couple of years, obviously, and that's helped. Obviously, we had some good years through 2010 when two Breeders' Cups. I didn't think that my career really took the jump forward after that I thought. I got more horses. I just didn't seem to get more quality horses. And so I think I had some of the leaner years after that. I mean, we were doing okay, but not what my expectations were. And then I've gotten some newer clients over the past few years that are willing to invest a little bit more money and try to get a little bit higher profile horses. And we've been fortunate enough to acquire some of those.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what your mindset is. Let's go back to 2010. You just mentioned the two Breeders' Cup victories and then things not quite taking off the way you thought they would at that point. You win two Breeders' Cups, you're thinking, okay, here we go. We're gonna take this thing to new heights, and you get to the top of the mountain. When you're not there again for a long time, does it make you want to get there even more?
It does. There was some tough years there. I mean, it was hard to keep your head up at times because it seemed like the talent in the barn was getting less and less every year, and it was getting a little tough to take. And all you can do in this business is keep grinding it out. I mean, horse people are very, very tough. And, I think that's all you can do is just keep going. You never know where a runner's going to come from. And a lot of times that'll turn things around for you.
Every trainer goes through those stretches, Brett. It's, you know, sometimes feast or famine. Other times it's very consistent. But when you're going through a stretch like that and things aren't going the way you hope they would, and you got to keep your head down and keep working, how does a trainer deal with those low times in their career? How do you keep going through it?
It's very, very difficult. I had some tough years prior to these last 2 years. Things were getting pretty difficult, and you have a lot of the outside people talking, and you have owners talking, and you know what's going on. There really wasn't anything going on. We were doing the same thing we've been doing for years when we were successful. We just didn't have the talent in the barn. And then everybody gets to talking, and it's just a spiraling situation. And it's very hard to keep focused. And even the help gets discouraged, you know. Winning is it's very contagious. And everybody, whether it be a groom, hot walker, assistant, anybody, when you're winning, everything's moving forward. Everybody's, jumping in there and helping and working hard. And then you go through tough times. You're not winning like you're used to or supposed to, and everybody kind of gets down and discouraged. So it was some trying times, and I'm sure glad that things are turned around, and I'm sure that won't be the last downtime we have throughout my career.
Yeah, but now you've gone through it, and you've learned what it's like to go through it, so I imagine that if that does happen again, and you said it probably will, that's just inevitable in the game of horse racing, you're prepared now. You're better prepared than you were even just a few years ago.
I think so. And, you know, that's what a lot of this game's about, too, is experience and learning from mistakes or the things you did right, things you go through. And I just try to stay focused and not let the outside influence get in my head. I see people go through these bad stretches, and they start changing everything. They change their riders. They change their exercise rider, their health, change their feed program. And if you've never been successful, I understand making those changes. And I'm open for change. I've always wanted to improve. But we just stayed focused and kept doing the same thing we were doing when we were successful. So I think that's hard to do. I think you start questioning everything. Everybody's questioning you, and you start questioning yourself and your program if you are doing things right or not. And so, you know, it does get in your head. But, you know, I never wavered. Obviously, there were some moments that, you were really questioning things. But we were able to kind of get through it and see a little light at the end of the tunnel, and now we've come out of it.
Yeah, as you were talking about that, Brett, I was thinking back to when I played baseball in college, and it's a lot like a hitter who goes into a slump, and the first thing you start doing is questioning yourself. You know how to hit. You know how to swing the bat and do everything you're supposed to do, but you start to doubt yourself a little bit, and you start thinking about your hands and your stance and your timing and all of these different things, and it can really get into your head, and it sounds like exactly what you went through on that front. But let's turn it the other way. Let's go here, and we'll start this direction. I mentioned the ACAC victory at Churchill last weekend, which is certainly a positive, and I can imagine that the only disappointing part of last Saturday for you anyway had to be your Texas Tech Red Raiders coming up just a bit short of pulling off the upset over number 9 Texas.
Yeah, that worked out all right, though, because I'm a Red Raider, but I'm also a big Longhorn. My dad played football for the Longhorns, and I remember as a very little kid, the only thing I had growing up was burnt orange sweatshirts with the Longhorns on it. So the game worked out all right. I'd like to see my Red Raiders hang in there, but Texas winning's all right.
Yeah, hook 'em horns. I didn't realize that your dad played for Texas.
He did, yes. He played football for Texas many, many years ago.
What position?
He was a running back.
All right. So either way, you were good with that. Did he go on and play in the pros or just in college?
No. Just got himself through college. I think that's kind of how he helped get himself through college.
Yeah, that's great. We'll talk more about Brett Calhoun's background here as we move throughout the program today. But, Brett, let's start with the big news here, the present. And when I say big news, I'm talking about Mr. Big News, who goes in the Preakness Stakes this coming Saturday, looking to give you your first victory in a classic race. If he can pull it off, he comes off that huge third-place effort behind Authentic in the Kentucky Derby at odds of 46-1. Tell me about Mr. Big News.
Well, I think it's a tall order, obviously. Fortunately or unfortunately, I've been able to watch Authentic train up to the Derby and since the Derby, and he does look like a beast out there. With that being said, Mr. Big News ran great in the Derby. Gave me a little thrill from the 3/8 pole to the quarter pole, thinking he might win the whole thing because I knew they had gone fast up front and maybe they'd back up a little bit to us, but give all the credit to Authentic and Tis the Law for finishing up strong after hot fractions. But Mr. Big News bounced out of that race very, very well, held his flesh well, and seems to be coming to this race very good. Obviously, we have to improve. We got to be better than we were last race. And I think he's a late-developing three-year-old that's gotten better all the time. You know, in normal years, we might not have been in this position. But for him, for Mr. Big News, the pandemic has worked out pretty well.
When a trainer says that a horse bounces out of a race well and is doing good afterwards, we hear that a lot. And sometimes I don't think people really grasp exactly what that means. What things were you looking for, Brett, after the Derby to let you know that he could be sitting on another big effort in the Preakness?
Well, the first thing I look for is weight loss. You know, if they drop off a bunch of weight after a race like that, or their energy level's down, they're flat, you know, that's a pretty good sign you're not going to make it back on a very quick turnaround. Now, there's other times that horses seem to come out of races good. You're towards the end of a campaign. You've had a hard year, but the horse seems to be thriving. They seem to be training well. They're breezing well. And you run them back, and they don't run well. And I think sometimes these horses will fool you that they'll look really good. And when you get to the end of a campaign, sometimes you just don't really know. They'll act sharp in the mornings, but seems like the eight pole hits them in the head sometimes.
What's the key to making up the 3 1/4 lengths on Authentic at Old Hilltop?
Well, I think it's a tall order, like I said. I think that he's going to have to be better, and either there's going to have to be more pressure applied to Authentic and soften him up a little bit more. And I think that's a tough task as well, because I think he's a very fast horse. It's proven he can carry his speed a distance, and I'm not sure who's going to be able to apply that much pressure to him. I mean, I think there's other speed horses in there, but I'm not sure there's anybody as fast as him. And I think anybody that's trying to win is going to have their eyes on him. Obviously, speed horses, but they get caught up chasing him, it could be bad for them as well.
What's the biggest difference with the surface at Pimlico and the surface at Churchill Downs? What's the biggest difference between those two?
Well, obviously, I don't have a lot of experience at Pimlico. I've run a few here. Been fortunate to win a stakes here a ways back on the undercard. I'm not that familiar with that. I'm very familiar with the Churchill surface. Obviously, it's a very sandy. It can be very deep and demanding track at times. I think the Pimlico tends to be a little bit of a faster track. Obviously, this morning I really couldn't get a line on it because we had so much rain. And it was a sloppy racetrack, but it was a very good racetrack this morning. So, you know, just watching the races for years and years, I know it looks like it can be a pretty speedy track.
Brett Calhoun, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Brett, I mentioned that if he can somehow find a way to win this race, it would be your first classic win. Of course, the best finish that you've had in a Triple Crown race is the third place finish a month ago with Mr. Big News in the Kentucky Derby. And I've often wondered with trainers, say for golf, for example, let's take a professional golfer. They point for the majors at the beginning of the year, and they lay out their schedule saying, okay, we want to make it to the Masters and the U.S. Open or whatever it is, and they point for those four majors. Do trainers, when you sit down at the beginning of the year and you look at your stable, do you start thinking about the three classic races, the Derby, the Preakness, the Belmont, and maybe a race like the Breeders' Cup, even as early as the beginning of the year?
I definitely think we do, and I think we even think about it a little earlier than that, honestly. I think as early as, say, November, December, you start getting through your two-year-olds, figuring out who they are, who might have the potential to get better as a three-year-old, the ones that are, you know, that are not going to be true classic-type horses, the ones that have the potential to be, and you start, you know, kind of planning at that point in time. You know, I haven't had that many good three-year-olds to even make me have the thought process like that until recently. But the one thing that I think we've done well with, and it's really the owners have helped allowed me to do that, is kind of let the horses take us there and not push to get to the Derby. I've seen so many horses over the years that were top horses that were pushed so hard to try to make the Derby. and then they never turned out to be anything after that. And I've been fortunate enough that the owners have kind of let me let the horses take us there, and I think that's why we're here today with Mr. Big News.
Yeah, you started answering my first question by saying that faster horses were the key to keeping your business rolling at a high level the past couple of years, but good owners are also a huge key to making a trainer successful, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a trainer, we all know there's a high turnover in trainers. You know, you're hired and fired on a regular basis, a lot like professional coaches or college coaches. You know, there's a high turnover rate. You gotta produce for everybody all the time. And I've been fortunate enough to have good owners and being able to get some new owners to come aboard. And the ones that weren't working out and weren't on the same page have kind of gone on to different places, and it's worked out very well.
Well, that's not the only horse, Mr. Big News, the only horse you'll be saddling on Saturday in a stakes race at Pimlico. You also have Ain't No Elmers, which, by the way, worst name for a horse I've ever heard, in the Miss Preakness, fresh off that big allowance win at Churchill Downs.
Yes, a very, very fast filly. You know, I think some people lost some confidence in her. Her first two races, she just absolutely blew the fields away. She really didn't learn anything from it, didn't get too much experience, and really didn't get a lot of seasoning out of those first two races. Next thing you know, she shows up in a two-turn race at Oaklawn, and she finds Gamin in there. That's kind of a tough way to get seasoned.
Yeah.
So I think she, you know, lost a little confidence then. It was a little bit of a learning process for her. I thought she took a step forward at Ellis in a grass race against older fillies. She kind of started learning how to run in traffic, be hooked, and finish running. And I thought that was a telltale race for me. And then she came back and put it together in the allowance race the other day. And so I thought she deserved a shot in here.
When you start working with young horses, Brett, even as young as two-year-olds or maybe even before that, you start looking at them, how long does it take you to know if that horse has that it factor, I'll call it, to be a really top racehorse?
I usually tell everybody, I try not to make up you have ideas along the way, but I don't think you really know for sure, obviously, until you start them. But I always tell people, until we work them 5/8 from the gate in company and let them eyeball another horse, that kind of is the acid test right there, to a true test, you know, having to get in the gates, break sharp, and eyeball a horse around there for 5/8 of a mile. You can get a lot of horses to work very sharp for 3/8 or a half, and at the end of the day, they can be cheap speed. But you get a couple of good horses in the gates together and work them a strong 5/8, they'll start separating themselves.
Talking with trainer Brett Calhoun on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Brett, I can remember when you first joined me on this show, what did I say it was, about 7 years ago now, we talked a lot about your background and the fact that you first took out your trainer's license at Louisiana Downs, and I guess it was 1993, and started your career working with horses that were bred by your dad, William. Talk to me more about that start and how you got the ball rolling initially.
You know, it was, I didn't really grow up in a family, a background of horses. I was just the typical young kid that, loved horses. I was enamored with horses and my parents were basically just race fans, and we did not have paramutual racing in Texas at the time. There was a lot of horse racing in Texas, but none of it was paramutual. And so my parents would go to surrounding states, whether it be Arkansas or Louisiana, to go to the races. And I learned to read the racing form at an early age and would send my $2 with them. And it just grew and grew and grew to the point that I was so obsessed with the horses and the industry that's all I cared about at that point in time from a very young age, 11, 12 years old, at the forms and all the publications, everything I get my hands on. And my parents always kidded if I'd spend as much time on my schoolwork as I did that, I'd have had a great career at something else. But I don't know. It was just something that I always wanted to do. My parents obviously tried to discourage me a little bit from trying to make a living in this industry because they knew it was a hard life. And so I go off to college at Texas Tech and spent my 5 great years there and came back and took a job selling advertising for about 5 years, but was pretty miserable at it. I really wanted to be in the horse industry. I stayed, you know, somewhat connected with the horse industry through that, but I wanted to make a full-time run at it. At that point in time, my parents were retired. They had a few of their own horses, and they had taken over the training of them when they retired. And I think once they got started in the full-time training of them, they figured out real quick that that wasn't retired life. So how this all came about in 1993 is they were moving to Louisiana Downs to set up for the summer, and I drove over to help them get set up and was staying for a week. And at that point, I'm not sure that I ever came back. I might have stayed from that point on. My mom and dad figured out real quick that that wasn't they didn't want to be tied down to something like that, and I took over a few cheap horses, and it was a real struggle for a long time. But, you know, I was pretty much out of the game on several occasions. It was just too stubborn, hard-headed to get out.
You know, somebody asked me in an interview the other day if I ever thought Horse Racing Radio Network would end up where it has when I started almost 20 years ago. And we started with one AM station in Lexington, and now we're nationwide on Sirius XM and broadcasting the Triple Crown and Breeders' Cup and all those types of things. And I said, you know, you never necessarily expect it. You hope it goes that direction, but I don't know if anybody truly expects it. So I'm going to ask you the question. When Ramjet crossed the finish line first in 1994 at Trinity Meadows to give you your first career victory, did you ever imagine you'd be sitting here as a trainer that's won more than 3,000 races and getting ready to run a horse in the Preakness?
I could never imagine my wildest dreams. Yeah, it's been quite a run. Those are achievements or, you know, beyond what I could have ever dreamed of back then.
How much do you remember about that day with Ramjet?
I remember it very, very well. he's a horse that was coming off a long layoff and had had a tendon issue. And we had kind of given him a lot of time off and kind of babied him along. And I think my dad was really wanting that horse just to kind of cruise around there and give him a race that day. And I remember vividly that nobody bet, and the horse had some traffic trouble, stumbled a couple of times, and then just drew off. And, you know, it was kind of like we were sitting there with our mouths open, like, wow.
Yeah, special moment. And, again, Brett Calhoun has gone on to win now more than 3,100 races and closing in on 3,200. He just continues to click along at a very high level. Brett, how much different, you've obviously learned a lot over the years, how much different is your approach to training horses now as opposed to when you did first get started in the mid-1990s?
Well, hopefully I've learned a lot over time. I think we learn every day. I think one of the things that, you know, that I've taken from way back till now is obviously every horse is different. Every one of them has a level, and because they're all a little different and have different levels, we have to train them a little differently. The little cheaper horses sometimes that are competitive on the lower end can't take as much training as some of the, you know, classic type horses that have to run a mile and 3/16, mile and a quarter against grade one competition. And I think, you know, over the years, those are the things that I've learned, and I think I've always known them, but I haven't really had the horses to really do it with until recently. I've had some very, very nice horses, but I'm talking about horses that are, you know, classic type horses.
Yeah, it's a great point. And that's the next question I was going to ask you. And going back to Mr. Big News coming up in the Preakness Stakes on Saturday for just a minute, when you're preparing a horse for a race the stature of the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness or the Breeders' Cup, is your mindset maybe a little bit different than it would be if you're just training that horse to get him ready for a start in a claiming race or an allowance race, for example?
Well, I think so, but that preparation started way, way back. I don't make any radical changes going into these big races close to them. I take the approach that I've had a plan. I've prepared them for that race over a period of time and just stay the course. I try to not, you know, change the game plan too much. Obviously, we're always having to call audibles in this business for weather or different things. So, you know, you get off your training schedule for this, that, and the other here and there, but just try to stay focused on that race from way back and have a plan from way out and stay with it. You know, you need to know your own horse and have confidence in your own program. Don't worry about what everybody else is doing with their horses. Everybody's got a different kind of horses that need a different kind of training program. So just don't let anybody else get in your head. Train your horse and pay attention to him, and that's kind of what I've done.
Is there a big race, Brett, that really kind of sticks in your craw a little bit, thinking, man, we should have won that race. If I had done this or done that, we probably could have won it. Is there a race that you'd like to have back?
You know, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but believe me, we second-guess ourselves all the time. you know, there's definitely things that you look back on and wish you would have done differently, and you hope to not, if you think you did make a mistake, hopefully you didn't make that mistake again. But they are animals, and you know, money more armchair quarterbacks. We do the same thing here. You know, what if and this, that, and the other. But you know, horse racing, you got 10-12 horses in there, 10-12 jocks. There's a lot of moving parts in there, and most of it's beyond our control once we lead them out of the paddock. So we just got to do the best job we can conditioning them and preparing them for that particular race, and then got to kind of let the chips fall where they may.
How about the other way around? How about a race that stands out to you where you did do everything right, and maybe the horse wasn't quite as good as he or she appeared to be going into that race, but because of all the hard work and the right moves that you made, the horse ended up winning? Is there a training job that you did that sticks out to you in that fashion?
Yeah, there was. I won a 2-year-old filly stakes at Churchill Downs. It was a graded stake. And her name has slipped me. A very, very good filly. Won a grade 2 there at Churchill for me. And she's one of those that she was a Texas bred, of all things. And, you know, I thought that was one I kind of had to pat myself on the back a little bit for. You know, she beat a top group of 2-year-old fillies. She was not supposed to win that race, and not only did she win it, she basically manhandled a group of well-bred fillies. It was funny because the sales were starting soon after that, and I ran into a very high-profile farm, and the guy jokingly with me, he said, "You're killing the breeding industry here." He said, "You bring Texas bred in there and win that grade too." But yeah, that was definitely a highlight.
Yeah, there have been a lot of highlights in the career of trainer Brett Calhoun. I'm going to continue this visit right after this short commercial break. When we come back, we'll look back on some of the other top horses he's been around over the years. There are plenty of those to talk about in the next half hour. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearlings. Over 550 cataloged with over 150 New York breds. Ranked among the top yearling sales in North America by Grade 1 and Graded Stakes winners sold. Recent grads include Captain Scotty, Field Pass, Project Whiskey, and Pumpkin Rumble. The Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic Fall Yearling Sale, Monday and Tuesday, October 5th and 6th, after the Preakness in Timonium, Maryland. Where will you be?
The test of time. There is no better example than Mill Ridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as a pillar of the turf. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 35 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year, nearly 2 per year. If you're looking for success in the thoroughbred business, consider Millridge Farm and its consulting arm, Nicoma Bloodstock, for it is proven and tested over time. The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making such stallions as Malibu Moon. Our current stallion roster includes Mosler by Warfront and Divining Rod by Tappet. Maryland's training center allows us to provide full service from starting youngsters to getting them to the races. We can also help you experience all the excitement of ownership with our partnerships, from the folding barn to the racetrack. Get in the game with Country Life Farm. Visit us at countrylifefarm.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
McKenzie set to strike in behind. Nowhere to go yet from fourth. Silverdust is fifth. They're off the turn. Mr. Freeze tried to cut the corner. By My Standard strikes the front 3/16 out. But Owendale's putting in a late bid. McKenzie wanders down to the rail for a final try, too. One furlong to go. By My Standard switches leads right at the eighth pole. Switches back and it's fending off Owendale. Silverdust up into third. McKenzie's back to fourth. By My Standards scores in the alley. Sheba wins by two. Owendale was second, Silverdust was third, and McKenzie checks in fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with trainer Brett Calhoun. That was Travis Stone with the call of the Ali Sheba Stakes at Churchill Downs on September 4th. Another greatest stakes victory for By My Standards. He has been on a roll here in 2020 for trainer Brett Calhoun, and I'll continue that visit right after I remind you that if you missed any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, and you can follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, and don't forget to join us this Saturday for exclusive national radio coverage of the Preakness Stakes. I kick it off 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern with the Equine Forum Show, a special Preakness edition, and then segue into our coverage of the races, plus some Breeders' Cup Challenge action from Keeneland. All of that coming your way from 4 to 6 Eastern time, and you can tune in right here on Sirius 219, XM 201, and worldwide at horseracingradio.net, and on affiliates across the country, which you can see listed on our website as well. And all that coverage provided in partnership with our friends at NBC Sports Audio Network. Brett Calhoun, that win in the Ali Sheba, By My Standards, just another big win for him this year, and you have done a fantastic job with this horse.
What a nice horse. He's just great to train. Obviously, you wish you had a barn full like him. Very talented, great mind, been very sound. You know, he just... The only unfortunate thing is he's got 2 losses on his record this year. One to Tom Zatot. I thought the jock on Tom Zatot rode a tremendous tactical race that day. That horse had been laying well back off the pace. We expected him to be behind us. That jock, Miguel Mina, made a tactical move early in the race and put him in gear in front of us. We had a different pilot that day. Our jock was not able to run that day, and we were riding a jock that wasn't familiar with our horse. He kind of sat off of it, and they went moderate fractions, and we weren't able to run Tom Zatot down, which is, you're not going to run him down with a slow pace. We ended up going to the Whitney, and the same thing. We had Jose Ortiz, who rode a great race on him, but we drew the inside post improbables in there and a couple more, and they were kind of tearing the gates down a little bit. I think it kind of spooked my horse a little bit. He just didn't get away super sharp and then stumbled, and Jose had to just kind of take a hold and switch out, and improbable got soft fractions again, and we were not able to run him down. We were able to come back and run big in the Ali Sheba. I thought those 2 losses before were pretty excusable losses, you know, frustrating. I really believe that we might should have won the Whitney. That being said, Tom Zatot was in there, and he did not get away good either. He might have been the best horse of all that day. But moving forward, you see what Improbable did to him in California the other day. I think that gives a bit of confidence in our horse moving forward to the Classic.
Yeah, I would certainly say so. And he's a three-time Grade 2 winner here in 2020. That's nothing to sneeze at, but obviously you wanted that win in the Grade 1 Whitney for the horse. So, Brett, spend some time talking about the economics of the game for a second and how a trainer approaches it. When you have a horse that's this good, you want to get him that Grade 1 because it can make a significant difference in his value, can it?
Yeah, the economics of these stallion prospects is huge. You find yourself under a lot of pressure, no matter if the owner's applying or not, because you know what those Grade 1 wins are worth. And in turn, you know a lot of times if you get that Grade 1 win, you get that big stallion deal, that owner's going to reinvest heavily back in young horses. So I always feel like it's a lot of pressure, whether it's a stallion prospect or a filly. You're trying to win a Grade 2, Grade 1 with. I've been fortunate enough to have a few of those. We sold for over $1 million. And there again, the owners have come back and reinvested. So I always feel like there's a lot of pressure to get those kind of things done.
All right, let's have some fun here in the second half of the show. Brett, let's talk about some of the horses that have had a great impact on your career. And many of them, well, we'll take the stakes winners, for example. And I'm going to say the name of the horse, and you tell me everything you remember about that horse, and we'll just move on through. Let's start at the beginning. Sweet Misty.
Sweet Misty, you know, early on stakes winner for me. Texas bred, had a lot of fun with, did a lot of things for us early in the game. We won a lot of Texas bred stakes, fortunate enough to win some open nice stakes with her as well. I trained her for Tommy and Margaret Landreth, who were early owners of mine, big supporters of mine that helped me get started in the early ages. I had more horses for them early on than anybody, and if it wasn't for them, I probably wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, that was a special day for you, Sweet Misty, winning your very first stakes race, and you were off and running after that. How about when I say the name Cactus Ridge?
You broke up on what you say?
How about when I say the name Cactus Ridge, what comes to mind?
Yeah, what a run that was for Toby Keith and his family. It was a lot of fun. What a genuinely fast horse. The highs and lows with him, you know. He always had his soundness issues, but was extremely fast. He wins the Arlington, Washington, Grade 3. We look like we're going to the Breeders' Cup. We happened to move from Arlington over to Hawthorne to stay, and we were prepping there to go to the Breeders' Cup, and looked like he was going to be one of the top three choices in the Breeders' Cup juvenile that year. And his last work before he was flying out within a couple of days, he injured a knee and was retired. But 4 for 4, I believe he had a few track records, stakes records, a tremendously talented, fast horse. But in the run with Toby was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I had the chance to sit down and do a 30-minute interview with Toby in his tour bus before he went on stage at Rupp Arena in Lexington. And it was a fantastic experience for me because all we talked about was horse racing, and he loves the sport so much. And look, you're a guy from Texas. We started talking about your dad playing for the University of Texas. You know, you grew up as a Texas fan, went to Texas Tech. Toby is a diehard Oklahoma fan. So how did that relationship work out?
I mean, he is a diehard fan. He's probably still suffering from a little depression right now after last weekend. But you're exactly right. He is a huge horse racing fan. He absolutely loves it. And I don't get to talk to him often, but I do see him from time to time. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of his. And usually when I see him, like you said, all we do is talk horses.
Yeah, it was one of the coolest things just being there. And I think he enjoyed it too because we weren't talking about his music career. We were talking about the horse business, and that's something he's very passionate about. How about when I say the name Mr. Nightlinger?
Brilliantly fast horse. I believe he won on the undercard for me on Preakness Day one time here. He was just a tremendously fast horse. Took us a lot of places. Wasn't the soundest horse in the world, but just a game, gutty, fast horse. Loved that horse.
Yeah, he was tough. You had another tough one, too, and it was one of my favorites, actually, Chamberlain Bridge.
Now, Chamberlain Bridge, he was quite the character. He was a little bit difficult to train. He would keep you up at night drinking a bottle of Milana, fretting over what he was going to do to you in the paddock the next day. He was extremely smart. He was too smart for his own good. And it was almost like he plotted and schemed things to do to you, to torture you in the paddock the next day. He would refuse to come out of his stall. You know, you'd hear all the whispers, that horse is sour, he doesn't want to do it anymore. But that was far from the truth. He was just quite the character, and he was always, you know, hard to deal with. In the early days of him, he was wild training. I mean, he was, you know, I'd have to walk up the track 20, 30 yards to grab him to walk him off of it. He'd be sky leaping all the way to and from the track. As an older horse, he calmed down a little bit, and he retired very, very sound. And I had a discussion with the owner late in his career about retiring him because I just didn't think it was fair to keep running him where he just didn't quite bring his A game anymore. He was right there, but he wouldn't really lay down like he would lay down and run like he had in the past. And he was 100% sound. He trained as good as he ever had. It was a sound and looked good, but it was just time. And so we retired him 100% sound. But he was quite the character. He taught me a lot, caused me a lot of pain and suffering and a lot of joy at the same time.
You know, people looking at our sport from the outside looking in don't often realize that each of these horses does have their own personality, and you get to see it every day firsthand. I asked you how long it takes you to get a sense of a horse can be a top-class racehorse. How long does it take you to get to know their personality?
Well, you start to learn their personalities pretty early on, but it's amazing how much their personalities change over time. From obviously when they come in the barn as a young 2-year-old to the time they develop into an older horse. And I know a lot of people poo-poo this, but I totally believe in confidence of the animal. I totally believe they know when they win and when they lose. It's amazing when a horse will go over there and win and how they come back from a race like that. They seem to just take these huge leaps forward off of a win. I mean, they're just beaming with confidence. And you can see one that you're having to run them in bad spots all the time. They keep getting beat. And a lot of times they just keep going down the ladder for no other reason in my mind other than mentally. They get tired of getting beat up.
Tell me about the day that Chamberlain Bridge won the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint.
You know, it's funny. We had won a Breeders' Cup race on Friday with Dubai Majesty, and so we went into that weekend, you know, with a lot of confidence. But Chamberlain Bridge was a horse that was notorious to hate the inside. He absolutely hated it. And went up to the post, to the draw, and he draws the one post. And I'm just sick. I mean, I'm almost nauseous because I said, it's over. You know, I went from thinking he can't lose to thinking he can't win in a matter of a couple of seconds. And yeah. I was just absolutely sick. And I'll give my jock, Jamie Terrio, a lot of credit for that win. He was kind of a kamikaze pilot that day. We were in the inside, horse outside, and tried to hold him in a little bit. And they got into the turn, and basically he just was jumping hills in the turn to get out. And as soon as he did, the horse exploded, and the rest was history. But what I was getting to, too, after winning the one on Friday, you're thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to win two. And the one on Saturday with Chamberlain Bridge was the one we might have more expected to win going into it until we drew post position one.
Yeah, it's crazy the way those things work out. You know, that's why they run the race, right? Everybody will say, oh, this horse has no chance. They'll look at everything on paper. When the gates open, Brett, you know as good as anybody, all bets are off at that point.
Absolutely. There's so many variables and so many factors, and And you see all these people that, they don't really understand, post positions are crucial. Some horses don't like the inside. Some of them don't like the kickback. So you can see a horse run out of the one hole one time and runs terrible. And so the next time he goes off at big odds, he draws the outside and wins. And everybody's going, well, how'd that happen? Well, the horse got the trip that he wanted this day.
You know, I've talked to so many trainers on this show over the years, and I mentioned this is your third time appearing here on Trainer Talk. Are you the type of trainer, Brett, that will bet a few dollars on your horses from time to time, or do you consider that to be something that is somewhat of a jinx?
I do seem to think it's a little bit of a jinx. I stay away from it pretty much. I bet on somebody else's horses before I would mine. I always feel like I'm stopping them, and I get a little bit weird about that. So I rarely bet on one of my horses. In the early days when I first started, I used to, I was a one man show basically. I groomed them, I bathed them, rubbed them, exercised them, walked them, and everything. My evenings were all my only entertainment was reading the racing form. And my goal every day was to try to make $50 at the windows. And $50 was a big deal to me back then. And I did pretty good back then doing that. Now I don't really have the time to handicap too much. So I'll wager occasionally, usually not on my horses, but usually on other horses.
Are you a pretty good handicapper?
I think I'm an all right handicapper. I don't think I couldn't make a living gambling on horses. I can tell you that for sure. But as far as handicapping a race that I'm in, I think I can do a pretty good job of figuring out how the race is usually going to set up.
Are you superstitious?
A little bit. Obviously, I'm like everybody else. I try not to be, but it can get in my head a little bit. I try not to let it, but I'm really not that, but it is in the back of your head.
So you don't have a lucky tie or a lucky cowboy hat or anything like that?
No. No. But I will say this, if I wear the same suit too many times and don't run well, that suit's done.
Yeah, I three strikes and you're out.
Yeah.
Trainer Brett Calhoun with me on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Dipton. All right, let me give you another name. And we talked about her a little bit when we talked about the Breeders' Cup victories, but that's Dubai Majesty. Tell me about her.
That's a filly we acquired privately. Interesting deal. I was at Del Mar running a horse in a stake. I had been interested in this filly for quite some time. I knew that she had run behind some really quality horses, and so I was pursuing her pretty heavily. And we had basically agreed on a deal, and I was very, very excited. And the last minute, my owner got a little chilly and got cold feet and backed off, and I was crushed. And I kept pushing and pushing, and he ended up buying her. And we put her on a plane from Florida and flew her directly into to Del Mar. And I had one of my horses there. I was borrowing a stall from Bob Baffert, and I had this other filly in another barn, and they were helping me. And so that was the first time we ever personally laid eyes on her. I had bloodstock aids, so a lot of people look at her. So from that time on, she was already shown talent, and she continued to get better and better and better and win some big races for us. So fast forward all the way to the race before the Breeders' Cup, which I believe was a Thoroughbred Club of America there at Keeneland. And this filly was not Breeders' Cup eligible. So she wins the prep race. She wins, I guess you could say, the prep race. Thoroughbred Club of America is a great race on its own.
Yeah.
And so she wins that, and it gives a little money to decide if we want to supplement. And I'm not that big a gambler, but I had to encourage my owners to put up $100,000 to run that filly in the Breeders' Cup. And it was really hard for me to ask them to do. But I just told them, look, I think this filly can – if she draws the right post, she's not down on the inside, jammed up in a speed dough. She draws the right post as Philly can win the Breeders' Cup. So they decided, they just won that nice race, and so they were on board. So we enter, and I've got her over at Churchill Training, and she had some ankles. She had some ankle issues throughout her career, and I knew she loved the grass, but she was such a brilliant, fast sprinter on the dirt that I never did get the opportunity to try her there. So I breezed her on the turf as a prep for the Breeders' Cup Filly Mare Sprint, and I think everybody was like, what is he doing? You know, what is he doing? But my intent was that she seemed to come out of grass work so much better. It was so much kinder to her. And she had a brilliant work that day. And there was some people in the works trying to buy her. And one high-profile bloodstock agent came and watched the work on the grass. And obviously it didn't impress him. It was very impressive to me and most of the other people. But didn't impress him, and they ended up not doing the deal, and it ended up working out great. We won the race. She goes over to Fazig Tipton Night of Stars and sells for, I believe, $1.1 million, $1.2 million 2 days later.
Yeah, what an incredible story, and it's amazing the way that this business and life works in that fashion sometimes. They say you'd rather be lucky than good, right? And things can break your way without any planning whatsoever, and you become successful in spite of what your plan might have been.
No doubt about it. I mean, you probably need to make your luck, but you'd be lucky and good.
All right, I'm going to give you another name, and I know you're going to be happy with this name because she was really special. Finley's Lucky Charm.
Yes, another brilliantly fast filly. She's a filly that showed us quite a bit early on, but she was very, very immature. She was one that, got you excited early, and unfortunately she got the owner a little bit too excited, and he wanted to try to stretch her out in some of the first prep race for the Louisiana Oaks series there. And unfortunately she chipped both of her knees, and luckily it wasn't much. But we cleaned those up and gave her plenty of time, and that might end up being a blessing in disguise, because she ended up getting some time to physically mature and grow up, and then she from there she was brilliant most of the time. We had a couple of tough beats with her, but ended up getting the grade one with her, and there again she goes over to Fazig and sells for $1.5 million. And I believe the exact same farm that had bought Dubai Majesty, the Shaddai people from Japan, bought both of those fillies.
Wow, fantastic. Stay in touch with those people.
No doubt.
Well, we talked about By My Standards. You're one of your current stable stars. Let's talk about the other one, and then we'll get ready to wrap things up here. But Mr. Money is the other horse I was going to ask you about. He has just been so good to you, and a winner of the ACK at Churchill last week.
He had a fairy tale year last year, and this year he's one that suffered bad from the coronavirus. Nothing went his way. They canceled a lot of races that we were pointing towards. His first race off the layoff, we go to Oaklawn about 15, 20 minutes before the race. He starts pouring. He hated the track. He never got in the race, ran poorly, and didn't get anything out of the race. So we move forward to the Blame. He runs a very good race that day. He makes a move off the turn. I had him and Silver Dust in there. They looked like they were going to be 1-2 off the turn, and he tired a little bit and was about six wide. So I thought it was a very, very good race. Well, then more trouble started because there was no races to they kept canceling one race after another for him. And I had nowhere to run him. And we ended up running him in a sprint allowance race at Keeneland, 6.5, which is definitely not his deal. And we catch CZ Rocket in there, who's gone on to do pretty well lately. So Mr. Money's nowhere close. close to a 6.5 furlong sprinter. So everybody's getting kind of discouraged. You hate to keep making excuses, but I know he had never had any fair chance. So now we go to Charlestown. No outside riders can go. We have to use a local rider. And for some reason, you know, the instructions were basically to put him in the race, take it to him. And he checked this horse repeatedly early in the first turn, just repeatedly checked him, and it was pretty much over. So obviously there's a lot of second guessing on the horse at this point in time, and it was so nice to have him have Gabe back on him and run him in the ACT-ACT and him to show up in a quality field and get back on track.
Yeah, so good to see it. And Brett Calhoun is certainly on track as he gets ready to point for the Preakness Stakes coming up this weekend. Not with Mr. Money, but he will do it with another mister. That is Mr. Big News. And he'll also get ready to saddle Ain't No Elmers in the Miss Preakness. So it's a big weekend for him. And Brett, looks like we've got about 2 minutes left. And I always like to end the show, and I've done this with you before, but tell us a little something about yourself that people might not know. So any other hobbies or interests that Brett Calhoun has?
You know, I'm pretty simple. There's not too much exciting about me other than my love for training horses, and that's pretty much consumes most of my life. My wife works with me, and, you know, obviously we like to go out to good dinners and have a good glass of wine and entertain, but other than that, I don't really have any other things that I do. Don't really have time for hobbies and things like that. And at this point in time, that's fine. I don't care to. This pretty much consumes my life 24/7, and I enjoy doing it. And you know, I feel fortunate to be able to do something that I love, and hopefully I can continue doing it for a long time. And when that time comes, I'll find some other hobbies.
Yeah, well said. Brett Calhoun here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Brett, listen, you're always very gracious with your time. I hit you up on short notice for this show, and you graciously said yes, and I appreciate the visit. It's been a really fun hour, and all the best moving forward, not just this weekend, but in the future, too.
Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for everything you guys do for horse racing.
All right, Brett Calhoun here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Just fantastic, fantastic stuff from Brett. And yeah, he really does have this thing rolling in the right direction now. And you heard him talk about it. Some tough times, lean times, not anymore. He's got it rolling, and he deserves every single bit of that success. All right, if you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. From my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.
Okay.
All right, cool.